From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Nermina Beganovic lost her mother, father, and brother during the Bosnian War in the 1990s. She was beaten and gang-raped by Serbian soldiers, and she survived. She made her way to the United States, landed in Portland, Oregon, had a child whom she raised as a single mother, and became an advanced practice nurse practitioner. She still feels the trauma from the war. She still battles ghosts. And she works with people who are facing the ghosts of their past trauma, people whose pasts are very much alive in the present. Nermina Beganovic is a fictional character, but she's based on the actual experiences of Bosnian women and girls who survived that war. Nermina's Chance is the first novel from writer Dina Greenberg, who says the story took her more than a decade to write. During that period, Dina Greenberg earned her MFA in fiction from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she also served as managing editor for the literary journal Chautauqua. Her short stories have appeared in multiple literary journals, including Pembroke Magazine, Split Rock Review, Thrice Fiction, Bellevue Literary Review, and Barely South. She now teaches creative writing courses at the Cameron Art Museum, and she is collecting the stories of intergenerational trauma survivors. Dina Greenberg, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I was telling you just before we came on the air how much I enjoyed reading Nermina's Chance, but it's not an easy read. I think you've said it's not a beach read.
Agreed.
But tell us how you came to write Nermina's story. Specifically, what is your connection to the trauma of the Bosnian War?
So I've been asked that question quite a bit. I will say that while I have no direct connection to the war, what stood out to me was the degree of suffering brought upon people in 1992 Bosnia, essentially on European soil. It was the former republics of Yugoslavia. And I think that as an American Jew, it was very difficult to sit back and essentially read news stories and reports about a genocide that was taking place.
Now, every war is awful because humans are killing other humans. But what makes the Bosnian War particularly traumatic? What are some of the historically accurate elements that you chose to include in your book, Nermina's Chance?
So I think, I won't say that the Bosnian War stands out necessarily from every other conflict that's been happening within our lifetime. But for me, I was able to connect with someone who had been in the war, someone who she was a TV journalist at the time in Sarajevo during the siege. And I was able to speak with her via Skype and get information that was so very accurate. And that's where many of those details come from.
And what are some of those details?
So initially, people were obviously very concerned hearing about Croatia. The Serbians were attacking villages and there was a great deal of genocide happening in Croatia. And within Bosnia, people were hearing these reports, and it's like any other war. I think it's very easy to disregard what you're hearing and say that this will never happen, just like what happened during World War II. And finally, the siege of Sarajevo took place in 1992, and during that time, the woman that I was interviewing, Srinka Brallo, she was inside the television station with her colleagues, and having to run out, having to be, running out and searching for clean water and clean food. These were things that people were encountering on a daily basis. That siege went on for 44 months.
Mm-hmm. And that is hard to get your mind around, the fact that we're talking about the 1990s. You're working with Kamal Pervanich?
Yes.
And he established a nonprofit in Most Mira in Bosnia. He and his brother, you told me, had been imprisoned and tortured in a concentration camp. And I reread that and went, wait, what?
Yes.
A concentration camp? This was the 1990s, not the 1940s.
Yes, exactly. So Kamal Pervanich is a young man who was imprisoned in a school, had once been a school, turned into a concentration camp. And this was happening all over. His hometown is Prijedor. And although that, I won't pretend to be a historian, but I will say that firsthand accounts from someone like Kamal, those accounts were able to make me understand what people endured. Many of the guards, many of the soldiers that were torturing their prisoners were neighbors. So this is a situation where there was a trust factor, and that became a burden because people would never know who they could trust and who they couldn't. So in Kamal's case, he had been imprisoned along with his brother for approximately, 4 months. And it was only a matter of chance that he was released. He went on. Many of the people in Bosnia found respite in places like Austria and Germany and Denmark and the UK. So there was a period of time where he was not in Bosnia. Many of the homes in Bosnia had been taken over by Serbian soldiers. So, this is one case of someone who is extremely damaged with PTSD. And yet he was able to overcome that. And he's established an organization called Most Mira, which is basically, it's giving young people who are Bosnians, who are Serbian, who are Croats. The concept is to bring all of these people together and try and teach them to have a relationship beyond what the geopolitics are setting out for them. They are trying to do this on an individual level. And this past summer, I was very fortunate to be invited to take part in a conference. Normally, it would be everyone would be in person, but because of the pandemic, many of the presenters were on Zoom. So I was one of those presenters. And it's become a very important element of my book, of Nermina's Chance, to kind of expand the platform and to have conversations with people who are experiencing what has come to be known as intergenerational trauma.
And that's something that, you know, Nermina's Chants, of course, explores all of that, the trauma that happened to Nermina, and then the trauma that then afflicts her daughter, who was born in the United States after the murders and the gang rape were long past. There is a part in the book, and we're gonna get to some of that trauma exploration in a moment, and the book is not just about that.
Sure.
There's something transcendent about it, but there's a part in the book when Nermina's about to head to the U.S. following her father's orders to get out of Bosnia, and you write that she doesn't worry about the money running out, even though she has a finite amount. She doesn't worry about dying because she's already crossed that thin line between living and dying. What do you mean by that? What part of trauma is that?
So I think that with Nermina, as with many people who have suffered trauma, what they're fighting for is to find some degree of trust again. PTSD is about having your entire world shaken. What your expectations are, what is normal, is completely destroyed. And there's very little to grasp onto. So with Nermina, she becomes very single-minded in that all she wants is a child.
You're listening to Coastline. Dina Greenberg, author of the novel Nermina's Chants, is my guest today. After this short break, we'll also hear about how she helps others process their own trauma through writing. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. When Dina Greenberg wrote a short story about a young Bosnian woman on track to become a doctor until Serbian soldiers raped her and killed her family, colleagues in her writing group urged her to turn it into a novel. Atmosphere Press published Nermina's Chants in October 2021, and Dina Greenberg continues her exploration of intergenerational trauma and the healing power of telling some of these old stories. And Dina, you said just before we went to break that so much of what happens with PTSD and trauma is that the person loses trust and is seeking to find some kind of solid ground to regain trust. Trust in what?
Trust in that a person's beliefs and expectations will be honored, getting back to that point of normalcy. So
like trust in life, the way life works.
Yes.
Other people, oneself.
Exactly. Trust that the way that person's world had been working, that person's values, trust that that you can walk out into the world and not necessarily be encountering danger at every turn.
You write a scene. This is a powerful scene in the book, Nermina's Chants, when Atika, her daughter, is confronting her mother. They're on a clothes shopping trip. And it almost seems as though Nermina, the adult here, the mother, is using her pain, the memories of her own mother's beaten and bruised body from the war. She tells her young daughter about how her mother, Atika's grandmother, was raped and how they wrapped her body in a blue tarp. It's an awful scene because you are witnessing a mother, it seems, almost attempting to traumatize her child? I mean, I'm sure that's not what she's consciously thinking. I don't know what it is, if she's trying to bring her daughter into this space that they can share, or what's going on there, bring her into empathy with her mother. Do you know women who did this with their own children? And is this part of what that intergenerational trauma is?
I think that that was an extremely difficult scene to write. And I cannot represent that that is, it certainly wasn't an incident that I read about or that I saw elsewhere. But I will say that where Nermina was at that point, she probably was unaware that she was going to have that reaction. And so I won't say that she purposely wanted to bring Atika, into that place of pain and suffering. But I think that it's a normal response for someone who is fighting her own demons to not always be, she's not the best mother. And I think that's a big part of her character. There was a lot that went on for me over the years of literally taking off the kid gloves with Nermina and not making her out to be this perfect individual. She had idealized her parents' marriage, and she had idealized what it would be like to be a mother. But at the end of the day, she makes huge mistakes. And this is something that I think many families, I've listened to stories from people who have had parents that were hidden children during World War II, during the Holocaust, people who were survivors of concentration camps. And they sort of fall into two camps. It's families who make the topic so taboo that they never talk about it. And other times when that's all the family talks about. So it's an incredibly heavy burden that people are carrying. And if it's hidden and it's not something that families are allowed to talk about, that children and grandchildren are just, they're forbidden. When that happens, that's very difficult. And again, and the flip side is if it becomes it's defining the family. It's defining, especially in terms of Judaism, I think, it's certainly a reason why some generations are just, they're not wanting to follow in those footsteps because it's too painful to think about and too painful to look at that history.
And yet, if you don't look at the history, if you're one of the families where that's taboo, it's still defining you in a way. It's still keeping you
absolutely
a prisoner.
Absolutely. I'll share an anecdote. So I am working on a series of interviews with, there are young women now who were anywhere from infant to 5 years old when the Bosnian War broke out in 1992. And I think all went to either Denmark, Germany, or the UK, Croatia first, and then these other places. And one of the women, the one woman that she wanted to remain anonymous, we had a quite lengthy correspondence via LinkedIn messaging. And explained to her that I was working on these interviews, and she was very interested. And she said, I really want to take part, but I will tell you that my family has forbidden discussion. And so I said, fine, we'll do the interview. And what she described to me was literally being uprooted as a child, young girl, maybe 4 years old at the time, and being taken, into a new country where she didn't know the language, where she didn't have any friends, and just sort of this fear of not knowing what is going to happen next.
And no adults explaining it to her.
Not necessarily, because I think it's a very complicated thing to be explaining to a child. But what really stood out to me is that when we were first corresponding, and our correspondence was very careful and very respectful with one another, and one of the very first things she said to me was, yes, I was not really affected by the war because none of my close family members were killed. And it really stood out to me because I thought, if that's the bar, it was just remarkable. And I guess I also need to make the point that these stories that these women have been sharing are so generous. And I feel just extremely grateful that I have I've been given their trust.
Yeah. You're part of the healing process for them.
I certainly hope so.
You're listening to Coastline. Dina Greenberg is my guest today. Her first novel, Nermina's Chance, is out now. She studies intergenerational trauma, specifically through the experiences of Bosnian War and Holocaust survivors and their descendants. And she teaches writing classes at the Cameron Art Museum in Wilmington. You have other veterans of war in your book, Nermina's Chance. And Nermina, maybe ironically, winds up counseling them. And one of the recurring ideas in the book, even those characters who maybe aren't so directly traumatized by war, is that they're so often reacting to the past. They're thinking about the past and acting based on almost ghost scenarios, things that are past and not actually there, even the limb that no longer exists for a war veteran. In that sense, is that just an illustration of the human condition? Like, we're all reacting to ghosts that are there. Do any of us ever leave behind the past and live in this moment with what's actually here now without the fear of the past?
I think that's a really, it's an excellent observation, and it's an excellent question. I'm interested in you're using the word ghost, because I think that I saw imagery in first imagining Nermina and seeing her in Portland, Oregon, which was there were refugee centers in the 1990s. So I didn't pick Portland, Oregon, just out of the blue. And there's a scene where she is walking and she feels like a ghost. She feels as though people can see right through her. And the veteran of the wars in Afghanistan, Jeff is sort of a composite character of some veterans that I met in the early 2000s when I was working on some experiential creative writing workshops for military veterans and their families. And yes, I think in a very general sense, we all carry our past, and we are always reacting to our past. But I think it's very different to be a combat veteran and be in a place where the expectation is he or she is carrying out actions that may be against a person's moral code. Typically they are. And it's, again, it's a very, very heavy weight.
Can you talk about the irony of Nermina becoming a counselor? Because when she first arrived in the U.S. and accessed services for refugees, she was pretty reluctant to go through her own therapy. And she's now dealing with patients who not only, as you put it, I think, don't want to let other people inside their heads. They don't want to be inside their own heads either. So can you just talk about her, the perhaps wounded healer?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That motif of wounded healer has really interested me for a number of years. And oh my gosh, that probably goes back to some of my studies at the University of Pennsylvania, where I was able, for one of my thesis projects, I was able to shadow hospital chaplains who are often dealing with every kind of trauma you can possibly imagine in a hospital setting. But what I learned about the training for becoming a chaplain or the training to become a therapist or even a social worker with a specialty in behavioral health is that those fields often attract people who have been through their own trauma. And I think that it makes complete sense that if someone has come through that process of really digging deep and really understanding what that pain is like, that becoming a professional where you are, I hate to use the term giving back, but where you're taking that knowledge of really digging in the trenches and understanding that, yes, you can come out on the other side, and you're probably going to come out stronger. So I very clearly saw Nermina becoming stronger, wanting to do something for others. And yet, at the same time, her struggle is never over.
When you were observing the chaplains during that time, what really stuck with you about, what did you learn from that? What was the biggest lesson for you about what the universality of what people want? What do they want, and how do they come through this?
What I learned, both in very, very personal, privileged interactions, I was able to follow, shadow the chaplain into hospital rooms where the chaplain would be ministering to a patient or a family member. I was involved in working group scenarios where chaplains were facilitating a workshop and various people were able to talk about their trauma. I think that the most powerful thing that a chaplain offers or a therapist offers or a civilian friend offers is the ability to listen and listen deeply and hold that person's story sacred.
And what does that do for the person telling the story? Why is that healing?
Because it gives them affirmation that what they are saying is important and it's honored and there's value to it.
And how do you, as a trauma survivor, does that ever really heal? How do you make sure that you're not wallowing and defining yourself still by that old trauma? How do you come through it and get to the other side? Does that ever happen?
I do absolutely believe, and it's proven in the literature, people absolutely come through trauma and come out on the other side. I've had the privilege of being with and working with a number of military veterans and seeing what they've been able to do, but I don't think that it's ever definitive. I think that people understand their limitations and they understand the support system that they are going to need and going to have in place. And I don't think, in that sense, it may not be different from anyone else in the general population. We all cope in different ways, but understanding, what is the danger point? What is your tipping point? Understanding when it's time to reach out and get help, I think that's really the key. So the more you know yourself, and the more you understand, what are the signs and what's your tipping point, then you'll know when it's time to reach out.
The wounded healer archetype that you say has fascinated you for years, is there a such thing as a completely healed healer? I mean, is there somebody who is not a wounded healer who is out there doing this work? Does that even exist? Is it possible?
I'm certain that it does exist. I'm certain that there are people who choose this profession who have not been through their own trauma. But I think that there is something especially resonant about someone who can speak to that experience. And, that's also not to say, of course, there are wonderfully whole people walking around in the world that you could apply that name to, who are completely healthy individuals.
Dina Greenberg, author of the novel Nermina's Chance, is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, we'll also find out how she takes care of herself after facilitating stories of trauma. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. How is it possible if someone is born long after the Holocaust or too late to remember any details from the Bosnian War, how is it that they still experience trauma? How does intergenerational trauma show up? And is it possible to heal it? Dina Greenberg is my guest today. These are some of the questions that she explores in her work. Her first novel, Nermina's Chance, tells the story of a young woman headed to medical school until the Bosnian War breaks out in the 1990s. Her family is murdered, and she is raped by Serbian soldiers. Author Dina Greenberg is still exploring this specific historical trauma by interviewing women born around the time of the war, and she's helping other adults tell their own stories of trauma through memoir classes at the Cameron Art Museum. She also teaches other types of creative writing classes at the CAM. But Dina, talk to us about these memoir classes. Trauma doesn't always come up, but it frequently does?
Correct. Yes. So I think that a lot of people come to memoir with the idea that they're going to be writing about, maybe a big important event, or they'll say, I want to record this for my grandchildren. And these are classes that will last 2 hours, and maybe we'll have 4 sessions or we'll have 6 sessions. So that's not a great deal of time. But what frequently happens is I will give a writing exercise, and lo and behold, someone will be writing about something that happened in their childhood, something that they didn't even necessarily think about for who knows how long. And the writing prompt will literally do its job, and it will jog that memory. And that's why it's it's kind of important. I think it's probably the very first thing I say, and that is that there has to be a confidentiality to the material because it's adults, and classes at the Cameron Art Museum are community classes. So, you know, we've got people between, I think we had the youngest student was maybe 18 years old, and the oldest student was in well into his 80s. And we weren't going to put restrictions on what people could write about and talk about. So, therefore, the restriction had to be that this is confidential and what we're talking about. Just like the way the chaplains would hold a story sacred, that's the same thing that I want to do. And yeah, lots of times the events are things that happen, maybe a sexual assault, maybe a very horrific accident. Maybe something as common as a divorce, a very tumultuous, dysfunctional household. And these are all relatively common things. And I think everyone processes things differently. Some people, although I would imagine very few, kind of waltz through life and process that information, but I think most struggle.
And so how do you, if this is a writing class and you're trying to coach them to become more effective writers, mm-hmm. how do you handle suggestion or criticism, if that's the right word, when you're talking about someone's personal trauma?
That's an excellent question, and that's also something that I cover in guidelines. So what I always talk about, and whether it's writing memoir or writing fiction or writing a poem, it's about what is best for the writing. So in a sense, we need to divorce ourselves from the material, so it's not necessarily divorced from the material, but set that aside so that we know what we're talking about is extremely volatile, extremely sensitive, and that is its own entity. How we talk about it, how we write it, how we organize it, those are all mechanics. And so the way I describe it is you're the expert on your story. No one can tell you how to tell it, or if you should tell it, or if you shouldn't tell it. And no one in a workshop group will do that. What I will ask workshop members to do is let's talk about the nuts and bolts. Let's talk about the mechanics. Are you trying to take a story that has 16 characters, 16 voices, and tell it in 2 pages, it's probably not going to work. So we'll talk about the mechanics of the best way to tell that story.
And you, as a writer yourself, you've been writing different genres for quite a long time, and you presented the short story version of Nermina's Chants to your writing group in Philadelphia, was it? And
correct.
They were like, what? This needs to be a novel. Are you kidding? It's not a short story. And then you came to UNCW to get your MFA.
Correct.
And what was that like? What did you learn in the program there that helped? Because you were also working on Nermina's Chants, the novel, while you were pursuing your MFA.
Yes. So I had a draft of a short story that I took to the Rittenhouse Writers Group, which is a wonderful writing group in Philadelphia facilitated by James Ron. They've passed their 25-year anniversary now. And I brought that story, and it was a complete mess. It was trying to take those 16 people and put them into 2 pages. So I had some really astute classmates, and I did develop probably the first draft, a very, very messy first draft of that. And then thrashed around for several years. And in 2012, I came to UNCW, and it was like a light bulb went off. Not that I was learning anything extremely different from what I had been learning in Rittenhouse Writers Group, but at UNCW, I was in an MFA program. I was spending 24/7 doing nothing but writing, sitting in workshops, reading other people's work, having incredible professors like Clyde Edgerton and Philip Gerard and Dana Sachs, and amazing classmates. So again, yes, a draft came out of there, and that was my thesis. And in 2015, I graduated and thought, okay, it's done. But no, it was not. So more work, and now we are in 2021, and it is done.
Is that unusual for a novel to take that much time? And I know everybody's journey is different because this is art. So you bring a lot of research and real human experience into this fictionalized version of somebody's story who escaped the Bosnian War. But it's art. And so I don't know. Are you comfortable with that? Will you write another novel?
Well, not if it's going to take 15 years. I will say that it took as long as it needed to take.
Yeah.
I spent a number of years procrastinating, doing nothing but research, and I think that happens a lot.
Is that an escape? Like, research I can do, is that a way of avoiding the actual writing of the novel? Or did that all need to happen?
I think it needs to happen. I think that I wouldn't have felt comfortable writing the book without the extensive research. But I think that, talking with lots of writer friends, it's a rabbit hole that's very easy to fall into. And if you like research like I do, it's really fun, and it can be very rewarding, as rewarding as writing. But I kind of feel I had given myself permission to really dive into that process of saying, well, now it's going to be a novel, which is not like a short story. It's really going to be this extensive 427-page book. Yes, I absolutely hope to write another book, and I do hope it doesn't take 15 years.
Well, so much of your work, whether it was writing Nermina's Chance or the interviews that you continue to do with the next generation of Holocaust survivors and Bosnian War survivors, you're taking in a lot of stories of other people's trauma. How does that affect you? What do you need to be aware of in terms of how it affects you, and then how do you deal with it?
Yeah, so that's also a really wonderful question. I learned a lot from being involved with the chaplains, and I learned a lot about self-care. And while I make a very clear delineation when I work with people, when I meet with people to explain, I am not a therapist. I am not a historian. I'm a writer, and I'm a creative writing teacher. I am also someone who feels things very deeply, and I know that that can be a danger. So what I learned from the chaplains is about self-care. And doing things that kind of, I won't use the term feed your soul because it's
because it sounds airy-fairy, but that's what you mean?
Yes.
Let's talk about feeding your soul. How do you feed your soul?
Yeah. So, for me, it's spending time in the garden. I love my garden. Spending time with close friends and family. reading, being in nature, all of those things, and making it a front burner aspect of your life. And certainly I'm not as good at that as I should be. But I know myself well enough to know that I can get mired. And that self-care piece, it's crucial.
Yeah. So you've found this niche and this fascination facilitating other people's stories through your own writing and through helping them write their stories. Will you ever tell your own story?
I love that you asked that question because I have been trying to figure out a way to do that. I think that there's always, for every writer will say this, there are autobiographic elements to everyone's writing. I've been looking at, I've been doing a little noodling around to talk about kind of base it in history. I grew up, I was a child of the 1970s. So it's different. There were a lot of politics happening, a lot of changes, but almost being on the edge of that. So I've been thinking about addressing it from a historic perspective. And I'm not quite sure what that story will look like, but I think that it will most definitely necessitate me looking back on my family dynamic, which probably wasn't all that different from most families. But in many ways, I think that there are still elements that I still will struggle with.
And every family has their own brand of dysfunction, and it's fun kind of looking at them all and laying out, oh, look, there's this flavor over here.
Sure, sure.
But that's really hard for you to look at. You've heard so much trauma. You've held space for so much suffering. And it's hard for you to look at your own. You want to look at it through the lens of history.
That's correct. Yes, I think you're right. You're right in that assessment. I do a lot of journal writing, which is an assignment that I often give to my students. So I do the same thing. I will sit and handwrite in a journal. I'll probably be much more apt to do that than overtly put that into my writing.
You've said that part of the value of somebody telling their story or writing their story is that then the person who reads it or hears it is witness to that and somehow validates it just by holding space for it. What value is there? And there is value. I'm not saying there isn't. But what is the value in journaling, in writing for no one else but just the journal and you?
Yeah, I think that the very act of writing, your hand moving across the page is exceptionally powerful. It's also, it's freeing in a sense that you are saying, this is safe. I'm writing here. No one else has to see it, but it's important.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Dina Greenberg, what a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel. My pleasure.
The book is Nermina's Chance, published by Atmosphere Press. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. And you can find this episode at whqr.org or just subscribe to the podcast. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.